Welcome to the deep dive. Today we have an extraordinary stack of sources.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, they're all centered around a really groundbreaking book called The Final Shield by S. Shields. And our mission today is, well, it's pretty massive.
It's basically to dismantle what the author calls the greatest con ever pulled on the human race.
Right. The fear of death.
Exactly.
The goal here is to show you, the listener, that there is actually nothing to fear from death. I mean, it is a perfectly natural part of life, exactly the way birth is.
Which is a huge paradigm shift.
It is. So, okay, let's unpack this. To understand how this con works, you know, Shields gives this great example. Think about buying a brand new computer, right?
Uh-huh.
And if the cooling fan is just always screaming and the battery dies in, like, an hour, you'd assume the machine is completely broken.
Oh, yeah, you take it straight back to the store, you demand a refund. Because it's obviously defective.
Right. But imagine if every single computer on Earth did that. Like, yeah. Imagine if we all just accepted that terrible battery life and the howling fan as normal.
Just because we didn't realize there was a massive, you know, invisible virus running in the background, draining all the processing power.
Exactly. And we're stepping into this profoundly moving realization today that human beings are essentially walking around with the ultimate background virus.
Yeah. S. Shields argues that mortality anxiety operates exactly like that background drain.
And it's fascinating because Shields has a 15-year background in cybersecurity.
Right, which makes this perspective so compelling.
Yeah, this is someone who has spent an entire career dismantling sophisticated scams and, you know, digital cons.
And Shields realized that the fear of death uses the exact same psychological mechanics as a scam.
It's an illusion. Designed to steal your joy, your presence, and basically your life.
So to dismantle any kind of scam, you first have to understand the trick, like the vulnerability the scammer is exploiting.
Okay, so what is the vulnerability here?
Well, the trick we've culturally bought into is something philosophers call eliminative materialism.
Eliminative materialism,
okay. Yeah. It's basically the assumption that the brain generates consciousness the exact same way a liver produces bile or a stomach produces acid.
So it views consciousness purely as a biological output.
Exactly. So the cultural assumption follows that when the biological machinery stops functioning, the output, meaning your identity, your memories, your consciousness, it just ceases to exist.
Full stop.
Right. Full stop.
So if I'm understanding this, it treats the brain like a meat factory churning out thoughts.
Yeah.
And when the factory burns down, the product is just gone forever.
That's the materialist view. Yeah. But looking at the sources from the physics world, the actual science points in a radically different direction.
Which is wild.
I know. Take Erwin Schrödinger.
Oh, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist.
Right. The guy who essentially helped build quantum mechanics. He violently disagreed with that factory model.
He didn't just stop at the math.
No. He followed the implications all the way down to the fundamental nature of reality. He realized that at a quantum level, the observer and the observed are, well, they're deeply intertwined.
Yep.
So based on this, he argued that consciousness is singular, not plural.
Wait, singular?
Yeah. He compared human consciousness to a gallery of mirrors. So when you stand in a mirror gallery, you see what looks like millions of different reflections bouncing everywhere.
Right.
But there is actually only one light source.
Oh, wow. And he also used the analogy of two different valleys, didn't he? Like leading up to the exact same mountain peak.
Exactly. What feels like billions of separate, isolated minds walking around on Earth is actually one underlying field of awareness, just experiencing itself from different temporary vantage points.
That underlying unity completely upends the materialist view.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to see modern quantum physics arrive at the exact same conclusion that ancient philosophy reached thousands of years ago.
Yeah, we see this in the mind-only theory of Vasubandhu.
The philosopher from the 4th century.
Right. Vasubandhu posited through intense introspection what Schrödinger posited through math, that the universe does not generate consciousness. Instead, consciousness generates the universe.
So the physical world is a projection of a deeper mental reality.
Precisely.
If we synthesize the physics and the philosophy here, a really clear picture emerges. It's like the brain isn't a generator at all. It's an antenna.
Yes. A highly tuned radio receiver.
So if you take a hammer and smash a radio to pieces, the music immediately stops playing in your room.
Because the physical hardware is destroyed.
But the radio broadcast didn't die. The signal is still out there, completely untouched by the hammer, moving through the airwaves.
The form is destroyed, but the signal continues. And if death is simply the receiver breaking while the signal continues on its frequency, I mean, that changes the entire paradigm of how we should approach mortality.
Absolutely. But okay, if the signal continues after the receiver breaks, the obvious question is, where does it go?
Right. What happens to it?
And the sources we're diving into, don't just leave this as a comforting theory. We have a mountain of direct testimony.
From people who have temporarily crossed over, seen the broadcast, and come back.
Yeah. Near-death experiences.
Now, a lot of people hear near-death experience and immediately think of the skeptical counter-argument, that it's just chemical hallucinations of a dying brain.
Right, like a flood of DMT or lack of oxygen creating a tunnel of light.
Exactly. But the clinical literature presented in the final SHIELD challenges that dying brain hypothesis directly. It focuses on verified external facts.
Okay, so like Dr. Mary Neal's account, that's a perfect example.
Yes. She's an orthopedic surgeon, someone whose entire career is rooted in the rational, evidence-based world of physical science.
And she drowned in a kayaking accident in Chile.
Uh-huh.
She was submerged without oxygen for over 30 minutes.
Which is staggering. By any normal medical standard, her brain should have been entirely devoid of function. And hallucinations require a functioning brain.
Right. But during that massive window of zero brain activity, she describes leaving her body.
Being held by Christ, experiencing this supernatural enveloping peace.
She talks about walking down a path with colors and aromas that, like, they just defy any 3D earthly description.
It was an expansion of consciousness, not a dimming of it.
And we see the verification of these expanded states in the story of Deborah King, too.
The ICU nurse.
Yeah. She had her own out-of-body experience during a car crash.
Yeah.
And then years later, she was treating a patient in the ICU who flatlined.
Right. The medical team resuscitated him.
And when he woke up, he didn't just talk about vague feelings of peace. He accurately reported watching his own resuscitation from the ceiling of the hospital room.
He observed specific, verifiable details that a flatlining patient with closed eyes could not possibly know.
He even quoted Deborah's exact words back to her. He heard her say to the doctor, "Let's go one more round."
It's incredible.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate here. Because something in these accounts feels almost contradictory.
Okay, what do you mean?
Well, if the other side is this realm of absolute unconditional love and it's so vastly superior to our physical existence, why do people come back?
That's a great question.
Like reading through the testimony of Dr. Neal, she actually tried to argue with the entities who were sending her back to her body. She was fighting them.
She wanted to stay.
Right, so why did she eventually agree to return? It doesn't add up for me.
Yeah.
If I find paradise, I am not getting back on the bus.
I hear you. But the reluctance to return is actually incredibly common in these accounts.
Yeah.
And it reinforces the reality of the experience.
Right.
She didn't want to leave that piece. But the entities communicated that her work on Earth wasn't finished. And the life review process makes this clear.
Oh, right. The life review.
Yeah. When people cross over, they don't face a cosmic judge. They don't watch a Hollywood highlight reel of their career achievements.
Right.
They experience exactly how their actions, words, and choices rippled out and affected other souls. It is a profound education in empathy.
Wow. So you actually feel the pain you caused someone else and the joy you brought to someone else exactly as they felt it.
Precisely. You experience the emotional wake of your life.
That is intense.
It is. And when Dr. Neal and others undergo this review, they often realize they haven't learned what they came to Earth to learn. Or they have more love to give, more ripples to create.
So they agree to return to the physical limitations of the body because they recognize that Earth is a school.
Exactly. That's why Dr. Neal later describes death not as a tragedy, but as an airplane ticket home after a really rigorous, challenging, but ultimately great adventure.
An airplane ticket home.
Yeah.
I love that. And you hear the same sentiment from Zach Tavkar, a 14-year-old in the sources who briefly died.
Right.
He didn't describe crossing over as a terrifying plunge into the void. He described it simply and peacefully as taking a seat in another chair.
Taking a seat in another chair. It's so natural.
It really is. But, okay, if we accept that our loved ones are just taking a seat in another chair and they're in a state of unconditional love, we hit the hardest part of this discussion.
The grief.
Yeah. Why does it hurt so agonizingly much for those of us left behind? I mean, the intellectual knowledge that the signal survives doesn't seem to lessen the physical pain of grief.
No, it doesn't. The human experience of grief is deeply visceral. And the final SHIELD uses the philosophy of Alan Watts to provide a framework for it.
Okay, what does Watts say?
Watts argued that you didn't come into this world from somewhere outside of it. You came out of it.
Like an apple tree. An apple doesn't arrive from space and attach itself to the branch. the tree apples.
Exactly. And in the same way, the universe peoples, you are a wave that came out of the ocean.
So the wave isn't separate from the ocean. It's simply a behavior of the ocean.
Right. It's something the ocean is temporarily doing.
And death is just the trough between the crests of the waves. The physical corpse left behind is just an echo, footprint of what the self has ceased to do in that specific location.
Yes.
But see, here's where it gets really interesting, but also really difficult. I have to challenge that metaphor.
Okay, go ahead.
If my loved one is just a wave that crashed back into the ocean, doesn't that erase their individuality?
That's the fear, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't have a deep emotional connection to the concept of a vast, undefined ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I love my specific person, their laughs, their habits.
Right.
If they are just absorbed back into the cosmic water, it feels like they are gone in a different but equally devastating way.
That is the exact tension explored in the book through a character named Danny.
Oh, right. Danny.
Danny is wrestling with this profound sense of erasure, but the realization he arrives at is crucial. The ocean does not miss itself. The ocean is whole.
Okay.
But you are a wave standing on the shore, and you are missing the specific shape, the specific motion, and the specific voice of the wave that was your loved one.
Wow.
The overarching truth that the distance between you is an illusion, that you are made of the exact same water and are part of the exact same signal, it does not negate your current reality.
The grief of missing their specific physical waving is entirely real and valid.
Yes. You are mourning the loss of the form, even while knowing the essence is untouched.
So it validates the grief without validating the fear.
Exactly.
You can be heartbroken that the radio is smashed without being terrified that the music is dead.
But that vulnerability of missing the specific physical wave is dangerous.
Because whenever human beings are in profound, agonizing pain, somebody usually shows up trying to exploit it.
And this is where S. Shields brings that 15-year cybersecurity background to the forefront again.
The scams.
Right. The same vulnerabilities hackers use to steal your data, panic, urgency, and grief are currently being weaponized in the form of modern AI grief scams.
It's so dark. There are digital platforms emerging that scrape the text messages, voicemails, and social media posts of a deceased loved one to train an AI chatbot.
They offer you the ability to text or talk to a digital clone of the person you lost.
It mimics contact, giving you a hit of dopamine, but it is the ultimate trap.
Shields heavily warns against this because it is fundamentally a closed loop. The author makes a vital distinction between an echo and a signal.
Right. The AI is an echo.
Exactly. It has no consciousness. It is simply algorithmically bouncing your own data, your own past, back at you.
It keeps you perpetually stuck looking at a closed window, interacting with a ghost in the machine.
A ghost that cannot evolve or offer new insight. A true signal, on the other hand, is genuine. It is an unbidden, unforced sign from the actual source.
Like a song playing on the radio at the exact moment you're breaking down in your car.
Yes, or a memory that surfaces with a sudden clarity and warmth that doesn't feel generated by your own brain.
And to explain the mechanics of how that essence survives the physical breakdown to send those signals, I keep going back to the Georgetown University Caterpillar study detailed in the sources.
Oh, the methodology of that study is fascinating. It completely challenges our assumptions about memory and biology.
It really does. So researchers took caterpillars and exposed them to the specific odor of ethyl acetate, pairing it with mild shocks.
They trained the caterpillars to fear that specific smell.
Right. Then those caterpillars went into their chrysalis phase.
Yeah.
And inside a chrysalis, a caterpillar doesn't just grow wings. It completely liquefies.
Its entire nervous system, its brain, its body dissolves into a biological soup of what are called mimaginal discs.
So the physical container that learned the fear is entirely dismantled.
Entirely.
But when those insects eventually emerged from the chrysalis as fully formed butterflies, the researchers exposed them to the odor again.
And the butterflies, having never been shocked in their new bodies, still avoided the odor.
They remembered the fear.
The biological container was completely destroyed, but the contents, the memories, the essence of the experience survived the liquefaction process.
It's the perfect biological mirror to the radio antenna analogy.
Exactly. The smartphone hardware gets destroyed, but the cloud backup of the soul, the consciousness, downloads perfectly into the next state of existence.
The memory transcends the biological container.
And if we truly accept that the cloud backup is secure and that the signal survives the destruction of the hardware, the anxiety around our own death starts to evaporate.
We no longer have to run that background virus of terror.
Right. And when you aren't paralyzed by fear, you actually have the mental bandwidth to protect the people you will eventually leave behind.
Yes. You can prepare for the end of life, not as a morbid chore, but as a final act of profound love.
And S. Shields refers to this logistical preparation as the medical keystone.
The physical binder.
Yeah, it's a binder that you create right now while you are healthy and clear-headed. It acts as the ultimate antidote to the chaos and administrative nightmare that usually compounds a family's grief.
It's divided into specific tabs, right?
It is. Tab 1 contains your directives, their healthcare proxy, outlining exactly what medical interventions you do and do not want.
So your family isn't forced to guess during a crisis.
Exactly. Then there's Tab 4, which is passwords, giving trusted access to your digital life and financial accounts.
Because ensuring your grieving spouse isn't spending the worst week of their life fighting with a bank's call center is so important.
It really is.
But tab 3 is preferences. And this is the one that highlights the true intimacy of the medical keystone.
Oh, yeah. It goes far beyond checking a box for burial or cremation.
Right. It's about the small, highly specific things that cause family rifts. Like, who gets the blue quilt from the guest room?
Or who should take over watering the rose bush in the backyard?
It is leaving a clear map so your family isn't paralyzed by indecision. And I love this quote from the book. S. Shields points out that later is the most expensive word in the human language.
The emotional cost of later bankrupts families.
Yeah.
The scam of later convinces you that there is always time to organize these things. Or that you don't need to explicitly say how you feel because your family already knows.
But the act of saying it, the act of writing it down in the keystone, closes the account. It leaves nothing outstanding.
It means washing your hands of anger today, resolving the lingering arguments.
It's saying the things you need to say now so nobody is left carrying the burden of unfinished business.
This shift away from later brings us to an incredible insight from a hospice worker named Rose, featured in the sources.
Rose, yeah.
Rice spent over 30 years sitting with people at the very end of their lives, and she began collecting what she called final words in a notebook.
And to be clear about Rose's methodology, she wasn't asking for a dramatic, cinematic speech delivered on a deathbed.
No, not at all. She was looking for a single organizing concept for a person's entire existence.
She found that the people who passed with the deepest sense of peace hadn't waited until their final hours to find their defining word.
They had chosen a word like love, peace, enough, still, or becoming.
And they had used it as a compass for decades.
Yeah. It really makes you wonder what word you're living toward right now.
Absolutely. If your word is enough, you can start letting that concept organize your financial choices, your ambitions, and your relationships today.
And this practical application is exactly why The Final Shield is such a vital piece of work.
Reading the book and taking its steps is a way of freeing yourself from the scam of fear, and gifting it to a loved one is handing them their very own ticket home.
Ensuring they don't spend their lives terrified of the inevitable.
Because when you remove the underlying virus of fear, the entire narrative of life changes.
Death stops being a hard period at the end of a sentence. It becomes a comma. Dr. Wong, another expert highlighted in the text, illustrates this using the ancient Kundalini practice of Satanama.
It's an auditory representation of energy constantly changing form, right?
Exactly. Those four syllables literally represent the continuous cycle of the universe. Sa is infinity, ta is life, na is death, and ma is rebirth.
It's a continuous, unbroken loop. Death is merely a threshold in that cycle.
And based on the staggering consistency of the near-death testimonies, the arrival gate at the end of your life will not be empty. Your loved ones will be waiting for you, specifically.
It is simply a change of state. The radio broadcast continues to play on a different frequency.
The wave crashes back into the ocean to become part of the whole again.
And the virus of fear is completely uninstalled.
It's a beautiful way to see it.
It really is. Which leaves us with one final lingering question for you, the listener, to mull over.
Think back to that Georgetown butterfly study.
Yeah, those caterpillars dissolving into biological soup. If the physical body completely dissolves, but the essence, the memories, and the hard-won lessons are securely carried forward into whatever comes next.
What specific contents of your life are you taking with you?
Exactly. What deep loves, what difficult lessons, what moments of grace are you actively packing into your chrysalis today?